This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and the views of our guests. And, well, this evening our special guest is Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. And we're going to be talking about the Constitution. Now, many of you have heard Pastor Whitney many times before. And if you continue listening to Radio Liberty, you're going to hear many times again, because understanding the Constitution is seminal and foundational to understand from whence our freedom comes. And one of the most difficult things is for people to discuss the Constitution intelligently, because it's not taught in our schools, it's not taught in our seminaries, it's not taught in our law schools, it's not taught in our universities. And people must understand the very essence of our government. Our government was to be limited by the chains of the Constitution. It was a unique document because the power of the government over the lives of the people was to be limited by the chains of the Constitution. And this is what people have forgotten. Our government was not to provide for the people. Our government was not to give the people liberty, because liberty was a God-given gift that... And the purpose of government was to protect our God-given right to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. And that's what it said in the Declaration of Independence. And most Americans don't understand that the whole thrust of our Constitution was to limit the power of the federal authority. Well, David, thank you so very much for being with us this evening.
Pleasure, Dr. Stan, to be on your show and to speak with your great audience that is learning the amazing things about our Constitution. You know, our Constitution is unique in a number of ways, one of which is it's the longest-lasting Constitution of any country in the world, that many countries have had, you know, one Constitution turn over and another and another and another, but our United States Constitution, over 200 years now. And when we look at the Constitution, the other amazing thing about it is that it has been changed so little. If you consider that really the first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, were all ratified together in one batch, that's one change, you could say, even though it has 10 parts. Really, then, the Constitution has only been amended 18 times. The first 10, the Bill of Rights, and then another subsequent 17 amendments following that. So for a document that has governed our country for over 200 years, it has essentially very little change to the document itself. As you mentioned, the sad thing is that most Americans, not knowing this document, have then had their God-given freedoms violated by a government that knows you don't know this document. They know you don't know that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and therefore they can get away with violating this document and violating our God-given rights, which is what the whole purpose of government is for, as the Declaration so eloquently states. Well, when we took a look at the Ten Amendments, we mentioned that once you move beyond the Bill of Rights, many of the subsequent 17 amendments actually broach the wall that our founders put around the federal government, restricting their activity, restricting the expansion of their powers. And it's very important to understand how that change took place, because you can see the direction that our country has been moving away from limited and decentralized government to the opposite, unlimited centralized government in Washington, D.C., which is what we sadly see too much of today.
But of course, it's never been done really by the process of amendment. It has always been done by edict and simply putting it over on the people. Well, David, pick the story up there.
I just want to mention the timing of some of these amendments. It's interesting to see that in the first year or two, 1789, the 11th Amendment was added, and it was just another, 8 years later, 1804, the 12th Amendment was added, and there was a long period of silence, just about 61 years, before the next flurry of amendments took place. That was the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, following the disastrous and a war that violated the basic structure of limited government, the war between the states, or the war of northern aggression, or some call it the second war of independence, the one we lost, whatever you want to call it. The changes in our government that the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment brought were just drastic, and perhaps the most important change is that each of these amendments basically said that Congress shall have the right to basically pass whatever legislation they think is necessary to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. So it kind of gave a blank check to Congress, first of all, to determine what was necessary to enforce this amendment, and then to enact whatever they thought was necessary. So that kind of blank check of power that was present in the 14th and 15th and 18th and 19th and 23rd and 24th and the 26th Amendment was a dangerous expansion of the federal government's power. And that all took place in a flurry of activity immediately following the war between the states. And then there was another period of relative quiet. There was a few attempted amendments, but they did not succeed following 1870. And it was another 50 years before the next amendment actually passed, and that was the 16th Amendment, quickly followed by the 17th Amendment, the one in 1913 and the 17th Amendment in 1915. And these, of course, were also followed by some other egregious amendments quickly after that, the 18th Amendment in 1919, 19th Amendment in 1920, 20th Amendment in 1933, and another amendment in 1933. And so there was a flurry of activity that took place in the early part of the 20th century that, again, radically altered our form of government. And as you mentioned, really since the mid-20th century, about 1947 with the Iverson case the Supreme Court heard, there began to be judicial alterations of our form of government.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and because Pastor Whitney is simply pointing out that it was certainly in the middle part of the last century, and in the 50s, 1950s, 1960s, when, of course, the people who wanted an authoritarian government in America knew they could never get that through. So they packed the Supreme Court with people that they knew would, little bit by little bit, erode the basis of our Constitution. That is much easier to do it by the judicial edict than by the amendment process. And, of course, then you can ignore the Constitution, and you can simply say we're a nation of law, and the Supreme Court has said, and so you no longer have rule by law, you have rule by a group of people wearing black robes who have been put into positions of judicial appointments so that they can modify our system of government as we move from freedom to feudalism to fascism. Go right ahead, David.
And so although, as you say, there has not been many amendments in the latter part of the 20th century, nonetheless, the radical changes are even more egregious and more violative of the form of government we have. And the evildoers know they can get away with it because they know most Americans have never studied the Constitution, and they saw to it that the Constitution was no longer taught in public schools or universities, nor in law schools of all places. They, most of all, should be studying it, and they don't. So they knew that they kind of had free rein because they could ignore it, and nobody else knew it anyway, and they could get away with it. Well, we intend to change that by teaching not only the founding principles, but teaching a working knowledge of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration, as well as the subsequent amendments. Well, we come to the two that brought about a very radical change in the early part of the 20th century, the 16th Amendment in 1913, and 2 years later, 17th Amendment in 1915. Now, most people know the 16th Amendment relates to income tax, but it's interesting to have a little background as to why this amendment was proposed and what it was about. You need to understand a little bit of the history of what was happening in the late 19th century as the Industrial Revolution heated up and really began to expand businesses. There were certain powerful elites that wanted more power and more wealth, and they recognized that the monopoly laws, the laws prohibiting monopoly both at state and federal level, stood in their way. So they designed a system to get around those monopoly laws, and the system was trusts that were kind of hidden legal structures that could combine a number of corporations together in cooperative arrangements where they would set prices together. They would make determinations as to what their business plan was and so on. And the result was the consumer was left out of the loop, and, of course, there wasn't competition. Whenever there's a monopoly, two things happen. Prices go right on through the roof because, after all, the monopoly can determine whatever price it chooses. And secondly, usually service and quality goes right down the tubes because there really isn't any reason for the monopoly to do a good job for their customers, because they don't have to. They can get away with it. There's no competition. And so in the latter decade of the 19th century, there was several moves that were made to bust these trusts. The most famous was in 1890, the Sherman Antitrust Act, and it declared illegal every contract, combination in the form of trust or otherwise, or conspiracy, in restraint of trade or commerce among the several states or with foreign nations. And it also included criminal penalties for the violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. Well, to follow up on that, in 4 years later, in 1894, Congress enacted an income tax that imposed a tax on the income of corporations. This was not on individuals. This was only on corporations. And again, their aim was to seek to have access to the financial records of those corporations so that they could expose where the trusts exist. You see, the trusts were secret often, and no one had access to the information as to which corporations were part of the trust. All this was hidden, and so people in the federal government thought, well, here's a way we can open the box and see what's inside the box and discover where these trusts exist that are in violation of the law that we passed in 1890, the Sherman Antitrust Act. And they knew the way to do that was to force every corporation to have a year-end revealing of their books, what their income was and so forth. So they actually imposed this income tax not because they needed the money. In fact, if you study the history of the U.S. Treasury, the U.S. Treasury always had a surplus towards the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. They had more money than they needed every year. They could turn money back to the states and say, hey, you overpaid us. Imagine the U.S. Treasury saying that today. That's $1 trillion in debt, multi-trillion dollars in debt. Well, anyway, that law passed Congress in 1894, but the legality of the law was immediately challenged in the Supreme Court. The issue was decided the next year in 1895. The Supreme Court case is Pollock v. Farmers and Loan Trust Company. And the United States Supreme Court ruled that the law imposing this income tax on corporations, the law was unconstitutional. But they did that ruling for a very unusual reason. The court ruled that the law was unconstitutional because it posed a tax on income derived from property. For example, if you owned a real estate and you rented that real estate, that was a profit, an income from property. Or if you ran a farm or operated a factory and all those things, the court reasoning was that to tax the income when the source of the income was property imposed a federal tax burden on the property itself, which, and you can read this in the Pollock v. Farmers and Loan and Trust Company, U.S. Supreme Court decision there in 1895, that they said this law breaks that which is the forbidden limitations on direct taxation by the Constitution, Article 1, Section 9. So the court ruled that any tax on property like any tax on an individual citizen, is a direct tax in the constitutional sense and therefore is illegal. The Constitution very clearly says, Article 1, Section 9, that no capitation tax is permitted. Now, if you ask, well, what's capitation tax? That's a term that probably most people are not familiar with. You're probably familiar with the term decapitation. That is to take someone's head off of their shoulders by whatever means. Well, a capitation tax is an tax upon the head, a tax upon the individual citizen who's an individual citizen of one of the states in the Union. And the Supreme Court, rightly interpreting the language of the Constitution there in Article 1, Section 9, said no direct tax is constitutional. A federal direct tax is only allowed by the Constitution to be imposed on the government of the states of the Union, not upon the individuals. That's what it means, the prohibition of having any capitation tax. And our founders were very wise in this regard, because they understood that if you give the federal government this power to directly tax the citizens of the several United States, you have given them a very, very dangerous power, and a power that once it's out of the box is never going to be limited again. So they did not want this power granted to the federal government. Rather, that power would remain at the state government level. We'll explain in a few minutes how that ties in with the 17th Amendment as a very important check on the federal government's power, not only of taxation, but their power to spend taxpayers' dollars for whatever federal budget that they have determined. So the Constitution does not permit a direct tax upon the individual. And the amount of the tax on the state governments is also restricted and determined by the Constitution, that it is to be apportioned according to the census. That is, when the census determines how many people reside in the state of California versus how many people reside in the state of Virginia or Maryland or whatever state you pick, then you can have an apportionment not only for representatives in the House of Representatives. That is, Maryland's a fairly small state population-wise, about 5 million. California, boy, I don't know, Dr. Stan, how many million you have there in California these days.
But we have 40 or 50 million.
40 or 50 million. Yeah. So you probably have about 10 times more representatives in the House of Representatives than we do in Maryland. And so not only was the census important for determining how many representatives each state had, it was also the way in which the tax bill was determined. So if, say, you are 10 times larger than Maryland, you'd have a 10 times larger tax bill to your state from the federal government than the state of Maryland would from the federal government. And then, of course, the individual state had the duty, the unpleasant duty, of being the collection agency. That is, they would have to seek means by which they chose, whatever those means of taxation they chose, maybe sales tax or income tax, property, whatever they chose, the state would choose the means by which they raise that revenue that they were then going to have to pay to the federal government to meet the tax obligations that that state had. So, again, a very wise design, because they put the state in a position as a go-between the federal government and the individual citizen of that state. So, just reminding you of Article 1, Article 1, Section 2, representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states, which may be included within this union according to the respective numbers. And then Article 1, Section 9 adds to that, no capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken. Very clear language. The Supreme Court of 1895 understood that language, and they struck down the law that Congress had passed the previous year to impose an income tax.
But I think that people have to understand that in 1848, Karl Marx had written the Communist Manifesto. What did he advocate? A progressive income tax. Why? Because Marx, of course, was commissioned by a secret society, part of this whole Brotherhood of Darkness, to bring about the centralization of power with government so the government could control the individual, which was the antithesis of the American dream. Well, David, go right ahead there.
So if we understand that principle, that obviously our Supreme Court clearly understood in the last 5 years of the 19th century, then we move to what happened following that. They struck it down, 1895, and still there was this desire to bust the trust. So the question was, how can we do this? In other words, how can we do an end run around the Supreme Court? The Supreme Court has said taxes upon corporations are unconstitutional. Fine. Let's create an amendment to the Constitution. Actually, President Howard Taft ran on a platform of trust busting. And when he was elected, and this is a speech he gave before Congress, June 16th, 1909, he was stumping with Congress for creating what became the 16th Amendment. He said, I recommend first the adoption of a joint resolution by two-thirds of both houses proposing to the states an amendment to the Constitution. Notice the wording of his amendment proposed for the Constitution. Of an excise tax upon all corporations measured by 2% of their net income. So they were proposing a constitutional amendment, which would get around the Supreme Court objection of 1895 that said, wait a minute, you cannot impose this income tax on corporations. They were saying, okay, let's get after the trust busting. And again, it was not a revenue-raising desire. It was a desire to get into the financial spreadsheets and so forth of corporations of that day to discover where these hidden trusts had been created and to bust them apart because it was really a monopoly by another name. And Taft proposed that in 1909. It took several years to work it through. And eventually, the 16th Amendment proposed and was passed by Congress and then sent to the states for ratification. Interesting thing about both the 16th and the 17th Amendment, there is substantial evidence that they were not properly ratified. If you read Article 5 of our Constitution and you see there the details about ratification, three-quarters of the states have to properly ratify it, and they have to ratify it as it came from Congress. They, as a state, cannot make alterations to that amendment, and several of the states did. They made their own alterations to it, and then they put it before their state and voted on it. So when they voted it in, they weren't voting the same amendment that Congress had proposed as the 16th Amendment. And then there was other states where there was chicanery that took place that it actually wasn't properly ratified in three-quarters of the states, according to the research done by Bill Benson in his book, The Law That Never Was. So that's an interesting aside, but let's say, okay, let's look at the text of it itself for the 16th Amendment and say, what was the original intent of the 16th Amendment? As I shared, the background really was to bust the trust, and the background was to get around the Supreme Court decision that said you can't tax corporations. And as Howard Taft said, it was only proposed to be a tax upon corporations. When it was ratified, there were some interesting Supreme Court decisions that quickly followed upon the heels of the ratification of the 16th Amendment in 1913. One of them is Stratton Independence v. Halbert. In this, the Supreme Court explained that the income tax was an excise tax imposed on activities involving the exercise of government-granted privilege. In other words, the government granted you a license to...
Hold that thought, David. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Pastor Whitney is pointing out that the 16th Amendment was for corporations, and of course, it was only for those who were operating under a government-granted privilege. In other words, they were the corporations. It was not a tax on individuals. So, pick the story up there, David.
So, they said it was on activities involving government exercise privilege, and the Supreme Court said in that case, Stratton Independence v. Halbert, 1913, that income is not the subject on which the tax is imposed, and that income is merely the measurement for determining the amount of tax. So again, they were even very specific in some of the details as to how the 16th Amendment was to be understood. And these are the people who were involved in the debates and the ratification. These are the people who understood the original intent of the 16th Amendment. The details they lay out are very interesting to read. Another decision that was a few years later, 1916, is Brashaber v. Union Pacific Railroad. In this, and this, by the way, is the cornerstone decision that the IRS, even to this day, relies on, what they claim it established the constitutionality of the income tax system that they currently are enforcing. But if you read the case itself, the case involved withholding monies accruing to non-resident aliens, that is, people who lived here in the United States but were not citizens of the several states. They were foreigners earning a income here, and yes, they could be as foreigners taxed because they did not have the right of a citizen to avoid any capitation tax, because only capitation tax was prohibited on citizens of the several states. And the court made it clear that the two limitations on the application of direct federal taxes discussed before, both Article 1, I mentioned Article 1, Section 2, and Article 1, Section 9, no capitation and so on, that those two limitations placed upon the federal government were not repealed by the 16th Amendment and still are in force in the Constitution. So in other words, not in terms of corporations. Yes, the 16th Amendment changed the tax structure for corporations. But in terms of individual citizens, that's important, it's citizens, not non-resident aliens or whatever, that this 16th Amendment did not change one iota of the restrictions on federal taxation that are in Article 1, Section 2 and Article 1, Section 9. That is, citizens could not have a direct tax imposed upon them by the federal government. It had to be, again, directed to their states, and their states would raise that revenue to pay the tax bill to the federal government. But the federal government could not have direct taxing powers upon the states. In this case, that oddly enough, the IRS relies on for their own justification for their enforcement powers, it doesn't say anything of the kind. It says the opposite. No new federal taxing powers regarding individual citizens were granted by the 16th Amendment. And again, this is the original intent. This is what the people who debated this amendment and ratified this amendment understood, and that's why the Supreme Court held it very clearly up in that case. Now, let me give a very important caveat at this point in time. I am not giving anybody any recommendation regarding what they do with their, quote, income tax. I am not encouraging people not to file or people not to be, you know, involved in that system, because I know that if you are, then it's going to be an extremely difficult battle that you face. I am advocating that we change our representatives down there in Washington, D.C., in the Senate and in the House, because they're the ones who hold the reins of the IRS, and they could change us and return us back to a constitutional form of taxation. The taxation bill sent to the states, and the states raise that revenue, you know, themselves, not the IRS, a federal agency, which is, by the way, under the wrong branch of government, even if it was legitimate. The IRS, what branch of government's under? It's under the executive branch. The executive branch has no taxing powers. It's only the legislative branch that has taxing powers. Oh, but there's a good reason why. The legislative branch doesn't want the responsibility for that, because they don't want to take the blame when it comes to Election Day, and they know that. So they've avoided taking the responsibility for what truly is their responsibility in terms of taxing powers granted to their branch of government and not to the other two branches of government.
Well, this is a fascinating insight into what's going on, and unfortunately there are people who have a different agenda. Because if you want to have a totalitarian government, you've got to provide for the people. You've got to get the people the idea that the government's there to help. The government's there to provide for you. And how can the government provide? It doesn't have any money of its own. The only money the government has is what it takes from us. So it has to be able to take the money and then keep the money and use it for police enforcement and then give some of it back. And we're just so grateful the government's providing for us. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and David, that's really a fascinating analysis of the background of the 16th Amendment. So how did we get from where we were to where we are today?
Well, let me just make a few more quotes, because I know what I'm sharing is, I think, for most Americans, mind-boggling. They say, wait a minute, how have I been successfully lied to? And they may say, David, I think you're nuts, so you can't be arguing this. Everybody in America believes the opposite of what you're saying. So let me just quickly quote two more Supreme Court decisions in that same year, 1916. One was Stanton v. Baltic Mining, in which the Supreme Court again said that the 16th Amendment created no new powers of taxation for the federal government. And then actually 2 years later, in 1918, Peck and Company v. Lowe, the court explained again the limited application of the 16th Amendment. Let me just quote the court, because these are not my words. This is what the Supreme Court at that time clearly said. The 16th Amendment does not extend the power of taxation to new or accepted subjects. By the way, you and I, as citizens of individual state, we are accepted from direct taxation by Article 1, Section 9. It continues, neither can the tax be sustained as a tax on the person measured by income. Such a tax would be, by nature, a capitation rather than an excise tax. So, again, in those two cases, the Supreme Court clearly explains it is illegal. Nothing has changed in the tax system that our government had. What took place following the 16th Amendment, very quickly on its heels, was the 17th Amendment in 1915. Most Americans have never heard this. They've never heard that up to, the ratification is very questionable, probably is not legitimately ratified, but nonetheless, in 1915, 17th Amendment put forward, and we've been operating under it since then. It said that senators would no longer be appointed by the state legislatures. Instead, they were going to be popularly elected from each state. So the system established by our founders was a very wise one. It was one in which the legislature of each state had significant power in the federal government through their senators. And it didn't matter whether they're a small state like Rhode Island or they're a large state like Texas or some other state with multi-millions of people. It didn't matter. They all had two senators. So actually this gave greater power to the smaller states. And the senators had to do the bidding of the state legislature. And if they did not do the bidding of the state legislature...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment with Pastor David Whitney. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and David Whitney is talking about the 17th Amendment, and of course, traditionally, of why the senators were elected by the state legislatures and were answerable to the state legislators, but those people who wanted to convert us from a republic into a democracy came up with the idea we have to have direct election of the senators so that they'll represent the people. Well, of course, they would not represent the people. They would represent the people with the money who were able to buy the senator's favor. Certainly, under the old system, the senator was answerable not to the people of great wealth, but the people, the members of the state legislature, and then would look after the state's rights and limited the power of the federal government. Once you had direct election of senators by a popular vote, why, of course, then you made the senator subject to the people who had the most money, who could provide the most money to the senators, and senators then were really up for sale. Before that, they weren't up for sale. They were answerable to the state legislature after 1917 and 1915, 16, and the 17th Amendment, where we see now the finest senators that money could buy. But before we go on, David, I do want you to get your telephone number, your website out there, so people will know how to get in touch with the Institute of the Constitution, and hopefully many of the people there will give serious consideration to getting a kit and beginning teaching in their own community this wonderful lesson of the foundation of our freedom, which is the United States Constitution.
And we pray that many people would get a host kit, because it's very simple to teach these principles. Most people, like I said, they are not familiar with the Constitution and may be a little intimidated by the idea of teaching this to someone else, but our host kit's designed for anyone. If you can play a VHS or a VCR, you put in a DVD, you can show the lectures, the 12 lectures by a constitutional law professor, John Eidsmo, two lectures by David Barton, that give you the Christian history and heritage, the Christian law and government worldview, a biblical worldview, which really was the worldview of our founding fathers, even though not all of them were Orthodox Christians. They had a worldview, a biblical worldview of law and government, expressed very clearly in our founding documents. In addition, our course will give you a working knowledge of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and then the subsequent amendments. And for every citizen in these United States, this is absolutely essential. If you don't know these founding documents, your liberties, your God-given rights can be stripped away from you. I was reading an article about what's happening with the Department of Homeland Security, recruiting pastors all over America, thousands of pastors being recruited to persuade their people that in the time of crisis, they need to give their guns to the government. When the government demands the guns, then the pastors are going to take action and insist that their people follow the law and do what the government says.
Well, of course, the law is not what the government says.
Exactly.
The law is the Constitution.
Exactly.
And the Constitution gives the right to people to keep and bear arms because the founding fathers feared the government, and they feared government edicts, and of course, government can create crises whenever they want to. In fact, they can hire people to go around posing as terrorists to create acts of violence, and then, of course, use the acts of violence and the uncertainty to justify declaring a dictatorship. And people must understand there really are people with a different worldview. And, of course, they belong to a number of organizations, which we talk about in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. And their worldview is that they are a lot smarter than we are, and they should have the right to rule over us, which is the antithesis of America, where, of course, the right of the people to keep and bear arms was pivotal to the fact that we would be free. And they put the Second Amendment in to protect the other nine amendments to the Constitution. You picked the story up there, David.
So if American Christians and churches do not understand their God-given rights that are secured by our form of government and our Constitution, they're going to have them stolen from them. And I think every church in America, and perhaps your pastor, might even question whether a course like this should be offered by your church. And I would ask you to have your pastor call me. I would love to talk to a pastor who wonders whether it's a good idea for his church to be having Institute on the Constitution taught there, and I can explain why it is essential in obedience to Christ to do so. So I encourage all of the listeners to get a host kit. You can call us toll-free if you want to order your host kit that way. And our toll-free number at Institute on the Constitution is 866-730-9796. That toll-free number for Institute on the Constitution, again, is 866-730-9796, or you can go to our web store, and our website is www.iotconline.com. That's iotconline.com, standing for Institute on the Constitution Online.com. And our web store has other resources there in addition to a host kit that can help you communicate these truths. And the fact of the matter is, the supreme law of the land is still the Constitution. Citizens should never give up hope, never wring their hands in despair and say, oh, there's nothing we can do. The tyrants, they've got all the power, they've got all the money, and now they're getting all the guns. Oh, there's nothing. This is something that every single citizen can do. It doesn't require any training in law or history, and you'll learn a lot of true law and true history by taking the course, but you can conduct this course in your family room. Just gather some people, friends and family together, or definitely in your churches and in your communities. This course is currently being taught or has recently been taught in all 50 states. And we're encouraged to see that spread across America because we know taking back our republic from the tyrants who currently are in power is going to first require this grassroots education of millions of Americans before we can take it back from the evildoers who their design as was the design of King George III, and the Declaration clearly states, was total tyranny. that is subjugating every citizen to slavery, and the only people who would be free are the powerful elite who control the wealth of the world. Well, going back to the 17th Amendment, so formally, the state legislatures appointed and controlled their state senators, the senators in the federal level down in Washington, D.C., very, very directly. And this is important in linking what we talked about with the 16th Amendment, because the taxing bill that was to be sent not to the individual, a la today's IRS structure, but to the state, that state legislature was going to have to, in turn, take the tax bill that the federal government gave to them, and they were going to have to raise that money there in their own state to pay it. Now, if you know anything about state governments, you know that the state legislature is much closer to the people, much more accountable to the people. These are people that may, you know, I think of my own district here in Maryland. One fellow's a jeweler who's my representative in Annapolis, and, you know, he's got a business in town. And people can walk into his store, as I've done, any day of the week and talk to their representative in Annapolis, the state legislature. And these people are much more accessible, and therefore they've got a much more difficult job if they're going to bring a large tax bill and impose it upon the citizens of their state. Therefore, the state legislature, if they want to be reelected, they have a very strong interest in limiting the federal budget to only that which is absolutely necessary. Anything that was frivolous, studying how frisbees fly or some ridiculous grant like that, they would eliminate it. No, you're not going to do that. Senator, if you vote for that, we're going to immediately recall you today. Pack your bags and come home from Washington, D.C. We will immediately replace you. That's why, up until the 17th Amendment in 1915, our federal government remained very small. The federal budget was very small. There was no plethora of programs and departments that have arisen since 1917. Department of Energy, Department of Health and Welfare, Department of Housing, and on the list goes, Department of Education, all these things. The gargantuan government we have in Washington, D.C. today is because of this dramatic change that took place in our government of the 16th and 17th Amendments being, well, questionable whether they were ratified, but nonetheless they became active in terms of how they were treated as if they were indeed law. You see, our founders understood that monopolies are bad wherever they are, and a government monopoly is the worst of all. So they recognize, and you can read this in the Federalist Paper number 45 in particular talks about this, that they had a counterbalancing power structure, that the states were designed to keep the federal government in check. They knew that we individual citizens would have a very, very difficult time keeping the federal government in check. But the state governments could effectively keep the government, federal government in check through things like the senators being appointed by the state legislature. And once they eliminated that check of the state on the federal power, that's when our federal government began to grow like a cancer, just very rapidly and very destructive to our form of government. Up to that point in time, the states had more power than the federal government. In fact, you read Federalist 45, it said that the federal government has very limited, enumerated, delegated powers, a small circle of powers, whereas the state governments have wide-ranging powers dealing with protection of your God-given right to life and to liberty and to property and so on, and the federal government has no business in that stuff. And you look at what the Supreme Court has done since the mid-20th century, most of the Supreme Court decisions have been striking down state laws. What was Roe v. Wade? It was striking down a state law. Lawrence v. Texas, striking down the sodomy laws in all the states. In other words, the Supreme Court was supposed to be restricting the federal government. What has happened? It's been turned around to do the opposite. And today it's restricting state governments from the powers that our founders knew that would be safely entrusted to the states and never would be safely entrusted to the federal government. So the system has been turned on its head, and the very agency that was supposed to keep us from having a tyrannical, centralized federal government was weakened extremely by the 16th Amendment and then by the 17th Amendment. And you could just compare the growth of the federal budget, the growth of the federal departments, things like the New Deal, all those, well, you know, he was a communist, FDR, really. You know, just put a different name on it, paint it with a different color, but that's what he was. And the New Deal was all communist kind of ideas being foisted upon this constitutional republic illegally. But he could only pull that off if he had senators he could control. Matter of fact, he had a lot of trouble until he threatened and actually did pack the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court kept striking down, this is unconstitutional, this is unconstitutional, until they got packed and threatened, and then they kowtowed and did whatever FDR wanted them to do. So we as American citizens have had our liberties stolen by a tyrannical government that is violating the law. And I believe we would be far better off if we eliminated the 17th Amendment. And there was one brave senator, Zell Miller, before he retired on the floor of the Senate. He called for the abolishment of the 17th Amendment, that this amendment would be done away with and returned to the old system, because he recognized that the states, he used to be the governor of the state of Georgia, and Zell Miller recognized that the state governments were hobbled and shackled by the federal government in ways that our founders never intended it to be. So anyway, repealing the 17th Amendment would be wise, and returning the 16th Amendment to its original intent to only tax corporations is only what's fair. It was what the law meant. And if the words on paper don't mean what they originally meant, we have no law. We only have tyrants who hold guns to our head and force us to do what they want us to do. In other words, we're all slaves, and nobody has any freedom or any rights whatsoever. If that's the case, which largely it is, the same statements our founders made in the Declaration of Independence apply to all Americans today, that whenever any form of government violates these God-given rights that we, the people, have been given by God, not by government, whenever any form of government, we have an additional right. And that right is to alter or to abolish such form of government and to institute a form of government that will secure our God-given rights.
But of course, David, the problem we have is the average American doesn't understand either the Declaration or our form of government. And until the vast majority of the American people really understand what's happened, understand the fundamentals of our Constitution, and then understand how we lost our freedom, nothing will change. And so that's why what you're doing is so vitally important. We have to get the people, first of all, to understand, and then really to care. Do you care about freedom? Do you want to preserve it? And, of course, we have the framework. We don't need a violent revolution. What we need to do is get back to our form of government, the legitimate government of the United States, which I support. It is, of course, the tyrannical form of government which has been imposed by the Brotherhood of Darkness and these other people who have a different worldview and a different world agenda that we must oppose. So pick up the story there, David.
And that's important to remember. We're not advocating any violent overthrow. We don't need to, because the law, the supreme law of the land, is still this Constitution. And those who are in violation of this Constitution need to be impeached, or they need to be replaced by election. They need to be brought to heel by the true government of America. We the people. First words of the Constitution. We the people. Government is by consent of the governed. And I have not consented. I have not consented to the violation of the 16th Amendment as currently practiced by the IRS. I have not consented to the destruction of our form of government that the 17th Amendment involves. And so on. So we can say, look, we the people do not consent, and we resist and will overthrow those who will not abide by it. But of course, if we don't understand the Constitution, we don't understand the Bill of Rights, then we have no grounds for raising the mighty force of American people that can turn back this tide of tyranny. And it's not that difficult to do. Again, you know, I'm a pastor, and 10 years ago, I had very little understanding of these things, but I knew something was wrong in America. I could see it with, you know, millions of abortions every year, with the promotion of sodomy. I could see all the things going wrong in our country, And I couldn't quite figure out, what happened here? Once righteous, godly nation, once clearly Christian nation, what happened to us? So I began to do some research and study and was led to study these documents and led to get involved with Institute on the Constitution because I recognized that if we don't stand and protect our freedom, we will have no freedoms left to protect in the end of the day.
Amen to that. Well, we've got a real problem, and ladies and gentlemen, I hope many of you will seriously consider getting a host kit. One more time, let's get your telephone number and your website out, David.
Our toll-free number at Institute on the Constitution is 866-730-9796, and our website is iotconline.com.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment here to wrap up this first hour of our program here at Radio Liberty. Well, David, let's see. You've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, when we move from the 16th and 17th Amendment, a very rapid fire changes began to take place as well. The 18th Amendment, which prohibited alcohol. Now, there have been a movement across the United States, a prohibition movement. Harry Nation and others led this movement, and they were seeking the prohibition of alcohol production in the United States. And the fact of the matter is, prior to the 18th Amendment, there were whole towns and some larger sections of states that were actually dry. Actually, here in Maryland, I know of one town that's dry. You cannot sell alcohol in that town whatsoever. And this is a power, again, as our founders designed it to be, a power that should be at the state level or even lower than that at the county level or at the town level, not at the federal government level. Because the federal government, when it gets in the business of prohibiting alcohol, what's it going to do? It's going to create a federal bureaucracy to accomplish a police task force that should be handled by the states or by the local municipalities, not by a new police power created by the federal government, which is what happened with the prohibition of alcohol, the agency that ultimately has morphed into today's Bureau of Alcohol, Fire, and Tobacco, got its start right here. And that's a bad organization today, violating our Constitution on a daily basis. It's one of the violations of the Constitution that our founders knew that the police functions of government should never be at the national level, the federal level. They should be as close to the people as possible. And that's why in America, the most powerful law enforcement officer was always elected by the people. He was the county sheriff. And actually, on the books, it's that way today. The federal government, their Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, or the FBI or so, they can do nothing in a particular county without the permission of the sheriff of that county. Why? Because the police powers have to be answerable to we the people by direct election. None of us elect an FBI agent or any controller over the FBI. Those are all appointed at the federal level, and they have no structure of answerability to any of us. Here in our county, the FBI pulled over a young man and his girlfriend driving down the street, rolled down the window, and they shot him in the face. They claimed that he was a bank robber that they were chasing, and there was nothing that young man did. And the egregious thing is, these FBI agents were not held accountable for this egregious act that put this guy in the hospital and nearly killed him.
David, we're out of time, but anyway, God bless. We'll talk to you again next month. Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we do hope that many of you certainly will want to get in touch with the Institute of the Constitution. If you've not yet read my pamphlet on We Are a Republic, it's very short and sweet and to the point, but it gives you an understanding of the difference between a republic and a democracy and why our founding fathers created a republic, not a democracy, and the difference between the two. And we have a four-tape set on the foundations of our freedom and so much material that you really need to get. If you have not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or seen the video, you need to get it. Because, of course, what everybody has missed is why the Supreme Court under the Roosevelt administration and subsequent administrations, began, Chris, taking God and prayer out of our schools. And what is the basis of the conspiracy against God today? And if you watch the mass media and CNN and so many of our programs, they're doing everything they can to discredit Christianity. Why? Because there are people in key positions who hate Christ and who hate God. And so if you'd like to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and then to really get into this even further, you need to hear my talk on The Forbidden Secret, and it comes with a syllabus that will tell you about the angel who rides in the whirlwind and directs his storm. And then our four tape or four CD set on The Secret Behind the Secret. Certainly the material we have, the four tape set on the supernatural and the book that goes with that, The Beautiful Side of Evil. The book Hostage to the Devil by Malachi Martin, and of course the book that goes, four tape set that goes with that, entitled The Wisdom of Malachi Martin, or four tapes or four CDs, whichever you prefer. You need to understand the true nature of our struggle, because it is a spiritual struggle being carried out on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. And then I do want to mention to our listeners out there, I'm very, very concerned from much of the information that I'm getting, that there are those who are planning to stage a feigned terrorist attack in America and use that to impose martial law in the United States. Would they do such a thing? Absolutely. In fact, they you can see these techniques. We have a four-tape, a CD set on the battle in Seattle, where, of course, they were demonstrations against the people who are meeting there from all over the world, the globalists, and their plan for a global government, and how they had people planted within the opposition. Many of the people who were there were actually paid to go there by the very people who were pushing globalism, and many of the leftists there didn't understand. And then the provocateurs come in dressed with their ninja suits and their black face masks, and it was all staged. So often they can do this sort of thing. And, of course, this is how you get riots going. So I would like to suggest, if you have not yet made your plans, to be able to function effectively should we have a breakdown in law and order. If you have not yet laid in your supply of emergency foods, you better start doing it. And we will tell you that talking to the people who provide the ready reserve foods, why, they're having real shortages now. They're having difficulty getting milk products. So many of the food products now are genetically engineered, and they don't want to carry them. Literally, all of the corn in the United States is genetically engineered, unfit for human or animal consumption. And when you, of course, get our four tape set on genetically engineered food, you realize the terrible thing that they're doing in poisoning the American people. You need to get our information on genetically engineered food, and at least 60-70% of the corn in the United States is genetically engineered, as so many of the other crops. And if you want to get good food, don't put it off. If you'd like to catalog, you can always give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. And if you have a catalog, well, remember that once these things come down, there's going to be no going back, and you need to be able to survive independently of the organized society. Our number again, 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, radioliberty.com. And we truly are involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. The music is not playing as it ordinarily should. And so I'm going to ask my producer to possibly get our engineer out here. But right now, let's go with Mr. Bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and we're going to have our special guest on here in just a moment. Well, this is, I guess we're in good shape now. We seem to have a little trouble with our electronics, but we're on the air, and things seem to be going well. Anyway, under any circumstances, our special guest is Mr. William Grieg this evening, formerly the senior editor of the New American Magazine, and certainly now writing extensively and doing radio, and we're pleased to have him here as our guest this evening on Radio Liberty. William, thank you very much for being with us.
Dr. Stan, it's great to be with you again.
Well, what do you think the major issue is that you'd like to talk about this evening?
As has been the case for the last couple of weeks, I think one of the most important things we can talk about is something that's getting nowhere near as much attention as it deserves, and that's the unfolding economic Armageddon. I think that we're nowhere near alarmed enough over what's going on.
And I certainly agree with you. I think that the average American thinks that this is going to be just a little temporary dip and everything's going to be fine, without realizing, of course, that we are probably at the end of this fiat money system, because no fiat money system in all history has ever survived. And certainly we are in terrible straits now, and if we were not, why you would not see them funneling literally hundreds of billions of dollars into the economy, trying frantically to stave off the ultimate demise of the current economic system.
Yeah, you probably have seen that video clip, and I mentioned it before, of Jim Cramer from CNBC, the fellow who does the Mad Money program on that cable network. I believe it's a nightly program, and he's somebody who's very manic and very theatrical. And he had an interview just, I believe it was 2 weeks ago tomorrow, as the countrywide debacle was in the offing. And, of course, the countrywide mortgage company and the countrywide bank are in a full meltdown right now. There was literally a bank run going on with Countrywide. You had one instance as reported in the Los Angeles Times of a fellow who ran another mortgage business, another mortgage company, lending agency, who had something on the order of $500,000 in an account in a Countrywide bank, who was among the people who queued up to take their money out of the bank because they were afraid the bank was going to go bankrupt and that they would be left without their savings. This is the sort of thing that tends to become a huge snowball. You don't know which increment will trigger the avalanche. You can have snowballs of various sizes and configurations, but at some point, when the snowflakes combine, the result is that they eventually congeal into an avalanche, and I think that's what we're seeing right now. But when you have somebody who runs another lending institution pulling his money out of Countrywide, which was, I think, what, the fifth largest bank in the country or something like that? It might have been the 14th, but it's in the top 20. And you had a literal bank run going on. That's a very important augury of very bad times coming. But Jim Cramer got ahead of this a little bit a couple of weeks ago, and he had this widely publicized conniption fit, screaming, they've got to open the discount window. The Fed's got to open the discount window. And, of course, they've opened the discount window, and now it is pouring this cascade of fiat money.
And, of course, really, there are only several things they can do. They can either pour money into the economy, or they can lower the interest rates. If they raise the interest rates, of course, they'll, which is what they really should be doing, why, of course, they could maybe have a little discomfort for a time and cure the problem. But no, they're doing exactly everything wrong. They're doing everything they can to promote runaway inflation, which will destroy the value of our currency. Go ahead, William.
Yeah, Jim Cramer's publicized tantrum was really interesting for a number of reasons. I mean, here's somebody who has really preached at the top of his lungs the bogus gospel of fiat money and speculative capitalism, meaning people who make money off of the system of debt. And as people have repackaged these debts into instruments that have been traded on Wall Street, there's been this increasingly unstable foundation laid that is now crumbling out from beneath the feet of people like Jim Cramer. And so as he felt himself starting to lose traction, he started screaming. In my blog, I compared his screams to the outraged cries of the priests of Baal, where they were in their confrontations recorded in the Book of Kings with Elijah, when they were prancing about their idol and crying to him to intervene and to consume the sacrifice. And Elijah came out and did a little bit of trash talking about how, well, obviously your God must be sleeping or he's off hunting or something because he can't hear you. And the priests of Baal began to mutilate themselves and otherwise do things that rational people would consider to be horrible by way of trying to provoke the interest of their supposed deity and still nothing was coming. And that's what Jim Cramer reminded me of as he was offering up his supplications to Ben Bernanke and the other Olympian figures who run the Federal Reserve, and they did condescend to open the discount window. What I find really interesting is that within a very short period of time, all of these major banks have been bellying up to the discount window to get loans. There was a piece in the Boston Globe this morning headlined, "Big Banks Have Been Lining Up at the Federal Reserve's Discount Window to Borrow Money." And the columnist, a fellow by the name of Stephen Sire, says the following: "Normally, this would be toxic news for the banks that have borrowed a few billion between them. The discount window is usually a place where desperate banks go when they have nowhere else to turn. It is a place where you don't want to be seen. Not so this week. A couple of days ago, Deutsche Bank was identified in print as a discount window borrower." That's Deutsche Bank, for heaven's sake. Then Citigroup put out a statement yesterday confirming it, too, had borrowed $500 million in a similar fashion. Within minutes, Bank of America Corporation, Wachovia Corporation, and J.P. Morgan Chase & Company did the same. Then Stephen Sire tries to reassure us here that this is nothing all that important. He says this was nothing dire. The banks were marching to the beat of the Federal Reserve, which had lowered the discount rate last week as a way of easing the market's growing credit crisis. Those institutions borrowed money via the discount window to make it available to customers who might otherwise get stuck if they relied on markets to refinance short-term debt. The banks don't appear to need the money, and they have cheaper places to go for cash.
Now hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is simply saying that when they opened the discount window, a number of our major banks, J.P. Morgan, certainly Bank of America, Citibank, others, were all going into the discount window to borrow money. And, of course, what they're doing is pouring money that they've created out of nothing. Remember, mm-hmm. Banks create money out of nothing. Simply, they just create the money, create the credits. There's nothing there. It's all imaginary. It's all a mirage. But they create the money out of nothing, and then they lend it out. And then, of course, you spend your hard-earned money to borrow their money, or you borrow it from them, and then you have to pay interest back, money that they create mm-hmm. out of nothing. But what they do is they create more and more money. It's highly inflationary, and as they actually expand the money supply, they decrease the value of the currency in circulation, so that if they were to increase the amount of money 10%, it means that the value of everything you hold incremented in dollars decreases 10%.
Exactly.
And this is how, of course, inflation comes about and the public is impoverished. You go ahead, William.
Yeah. It's the point that I was sort of striving toward in a rather elliptical fashion was that Jim Cramer, in explaining why he had this seizure on MSNBC trying to implore the Federal Reserve to do what it's doing, he wrote a piece saying, well, the thing is, you're losing money right now. If you own a home, if you own investments, if you trade on Wall Street, you're losing money right now on account of this liquidity crisis. And I thought, good, he's actually coming to his senses, and he's going to start explaining to people the entire racket that the Federal Reserve represents, which is that they create this bogus money, and by putting it into circulation, they devalue the money which is being saved by conscientious and thrifty people. No, that's not what Jim Cramer said, because he went on to say, well, you're not losing money if it's sitting in the bank. And I'm saying, no, that's exactly what's happening right now, because the Federal Reserve's pumped something like $100 billion into the economy, created it ex nihilo, backed by nothing, and it's being lent out, and people will pay real interest on this bogus money. But more importantly, by making this so-called money, by lending it, whether you're talking about people who have electronic wire transfers, meaning that an increment of zeros is shifted from one column to another at the click of a mouse, whether you're talking about people who actually take physical possession of newly minted Federal Reserve notes, every increment of money that goes into the money supply represents a tax on everybody who uses money, because the value of our money is stolen from us and transferred to profligate people who are politically connected, whether you're talking about the big banks or government. Or do I repeat myself, because they're pretty much part of the same compound evil. But the thing that I find most remarkable here is the way that people are always trying to placate the public over the portents that we're seeing here, the implications of these developments. No, this is nothing that we should be alarmed about. Yes, all these blue chip banks, the biggest names in that industry, are queuing up to get loans from the discount window at the Fed, but they're doing this because the Fed has asked them to, so it's okay. Well, that doesn't follow. That's a logical disconnect. It is a big thing, and the reason why they're doing this is because suddenly these people are being touched up to take up the burden that is being put down by banks like Countrywide. A lot of the people who got out of Countrywide got into Bank of America. Bank of America is one of the handful of mega banks that is listed here, admitting that they went to the Fed's discount window to get this new heaping helping of supposed money. And while this is going on, all of us who've tried to save money, who tried to live frugally and put money away on the assumption that it's something that we will be using to invest later or to bequeath to our children, or we're otherwise making plans to use our money soberly, the value of our money is being stolen. And it simply cannot stop where it is right now. It's the sort of a thing, as I said, that will gather momentum in much the same way that an avalanche does, because you've got, as I said before, something on the order of $13 trillion, once all the leverages are taken into account, something on the order of $13 trillion tied up in this mortgage and equity bubble, and mortgage, equity, and real estate bubble. And it's a bubble made of little bubbles. It's a compound bubble, if you will. And they're popping faster than new ones can be inflated. And that's not to say they're going to stop trying to inflate them. And that's where the real danger lies. You know, rather than letting the bad loans be shaken out and resolved and liquidated as necessary, which, of course, would mean a depression in the real estate market and a depression elsewhere where people have been operating on credit, you know, promiscuously, because that's what the Fed has encouraged people to do. Rather than taking that course, which is a difficult thing to do and a painful thing to do, the Fed is doing what people in circumstances like this always do, which is to say they're trying to defer the day of reckoning. And as they defer that day, it gets worse and worse. And they can't delay it much longer. It's just a question of how ruinous is it going to be, and who's going to be able to swoop in and pick up the pieces once our economy finishes destroying itself. And that's something else that we've talked about before, Dr. Stan. And just, I believe it was yesterday, the Financial Times had a piece talking about how some people in the Bush administration have started to discuss with some concern this idea of the sovereign wealth funds, which is to say these state-owned investment enterprises, which are run by governments both in Europe and in Asia. And, of course, you have China with huge sovereign wealth funds poised to buy up most of the valuable infrastructure of our country. The Saudis, most of the petro regimes in the Middle East have sovereign wealth funds. Some relatively benign governments in Europe have them as well. Governments like Norway, by and large, anybody who's got oil, anybody who has energy interests, any country who's blessed in that way is going to have a sovereign wealth fund, because that's where most of the money is going right now. But finally, there's some discussion of this in a way that admits that there's a real downside. There's a great deal of downside potential where we're entering a phase of international trade in which governments can and will be looking at our assets as opposed to looking at our currency as a place for investment.
Well, you know, I think one of the most important things, William, is the fact that the average individual believes what he is told. He is told, well, really things are not so bad. We don't have much inflation. 2.2%, well, maybe a little higher than that. Anyway, if you want to add in, of course, food and fuel, which we all have to use, but it's only 4.4% when we add that in. And, of course, the truth of the matter is they're lying.
Yeah.
I mean, the independent economists we depend on estimate that the current inflation rate is about 11%. I mean,
yeah.
Remember what the price of gasoline and oil and diesel was 3 years ago? I mean, you go up into the market today, and you'll find that, you know, the price of milk and eggs and corn and of meat and all of these things are going up at double-digit inflation.
Yeah.
They're between 10 and 20%, and they're simply lying to the American people. And as that happens, it means, of course, the value of your money is decreasing. They don't want you to know that. They want you to do what everybody else is doing. Well, they're going to be secure. We want you to go ahead and put your money into T-bills, and you're going to get 3% in interest on that, because you'll have to pay interest on it. Well, if you have your money in T-bills at 3% interest now, it used to be 4%, but so many people are getting into T-bills that the price of the T-bills has gone up, but the interest on T-bills has gone down. But if you're in T-bills and you're getting 3% and you're paying income tax on that, and inflation is 11% this year, and it'll be 12 or 14% next year, well, you're going behind. Well, you can see how much you're going behind. They do not want the American people to know that this is what happens in every country that's ever had a fiat money system. And, of course, we are at the end of this cycle.
Well, we have to be, because really there's no place else to go here. Japan had a similar situation when their real estate speculative bubble burst in the late 80s or early 90s, and they went through a depression that lasted about 10 years or so, and they managed to shake out of it quite well. You know, Argentina has been through and continues to be, to a certain extent, mired in what we'd have to call a depression. But things are actually better in Argentina right now because prices are low. That's what a depression is, a system-wide decline in prices, you know. And you can get practically anything you want in Argentina. You can get anything there that you can get here, any necessity, any luxury item, for very little money, but you can't get any credit, which is a better way to arrange things. It's just that they had to go through about 2.5 or 3 years of outright national panic and crisis in order to get to that point. And I believe that as painful as it would be, and as horrible as it would be, horrifying in many ways, to undergo the necessary correction here, and the correction would be a depression, it would be better than what we're likely to get the longer they try to forestall the inevitable consequences. And the problem is, we may have reached, as you pointed out, Dr. Stan, we may have reached the point of no return here. Because after a certain point, if you want to use the astronomical or the astrophysical metaphor here, after a certain point, if a star reaches a certain mass and it explodes, it falls in on itself and becomes a black hole. And we may have reached a point where we're headed for a supernova as opposed to a more modest type of a nova. And the supernova will expand, and then it'll collapse on itself. We'll end up with a black hole, which would be the worst of all situations here. We'd end up with economic and cultural collapse coupled with existing and already functioning police state superstructure. And I really don't like the implications of that, but that appears to be where we're headed right now. And I've talked with a lot of people who are observers and students of what's going on. They say, actually, our ironic hope might be that the government runs out of money before it can finish the plans to create the police state, or to implement it in any case.
Well, I think that the average individual doesn't understand economic cycles. You know, the people in Argentina lost three-quarters of the value of all of the currency. They one morning they woke up and they announced all the banks were closed, and they devalued the peso by 75%. And, of course, up to that point, the government had guaranteed it would be tied to the dollar. You can trust it. The peso is as good as the dollar.
Yeah,
that was
their problem.
Today, it's worth 25 cents on what it was before. And the people were impoverished, but they got through it. I wonder if we will.
You know, Argentina, in some ways, is the country in Latin America most like the United States. They've been through some experiences similar to ours. They had a perfectly abhorrent regime in the 70s and 80s under Galtieri and the others that was superficially but not in principle anti-communist. They had that going for them and nothing else that I can think of. They had their own war against terrorists who were causing a great deal of havoc in the southern cone of this hemisphere, Soviet and Cuban-sponsored and Soviet and Cuban-trained insurrectionaries and urban guerrillas and so forth. But the regime that was fighting them was almost in some ways as bad, and they did have a period where they were consigning people to indefinite detention. They were simply disappearing them. That was, I think, the first place where you heard the word disappear as a transitive verb here. I will disappear him is the term of art that entered the vocabulary here. And then they ended up fighting that stupid war in 1982 with Great Britain, which is ironic because Argentina is a very Anglophile country in many ways. I understand there's a replica of Big Ben in Buenos Aires, and that they have high tea in that city as well. And so really, in terms of their preferred culture and in terms of their lifestyle, you're probably familiar with the gauchos, the legendary Argentinian cowboys. It's really quite similar to the United States. And they made the mistake of pegging their currency to the dollar, which is it's such a strange thing when people peg their currencies to something that has no innate worth. It just strikes me as really bizarre. But as tumultuous and as tragic as it was for them to suffer the collapse of their currency, they have found a place. Their descent stopped somewhere before they hit the bottom, and they're starting to recover. The problem is, we have such unrealistic expectations of this country as to what kind of lifestyle we can have, what kind of lifestyle we can afford, that I really don't know that we would maintain our perspective if we were to undergo that same kind of purgative collapse of our currency. It's interesting to me when you take a look at the rampant, omnivorous materialism of the typical American consumer, typical American household. There's not a sense that you have to defer your gratification, defer the experience of buying a home until you can actually afford a home, or to buy a brand new car or a luxury vehicle, such as a boat, for instance, until such a time that you're making enough money that you can comfortably afford it. And that's because credit has been kept artificially low, and we've been encouraged by both the political and banking elite to go into debt. We live in a culture of debt. It's something that we're acculturated into when we go to college, when it's almost impossible. When I went to college, 20 years ago or so, everywhere I'd go in the student union building, there were people there every, I think it was Tuesday and Thursday, trying to get people to sign up for credit cards, which, of course, is an almost irresistible temptation for somebody who's a cash-strapped and hungry college student. And when you come out of college, the expectation is that pretty soon you're going to go out and buy a house, particularly if you get married somewhere around that age, 22, 23, 24 or so, as opposed to saving and deferring that until later on in life, as our parents did and as their parents did as well at a time when the economy was healthier. And in spite of the fact that we have this consumer lifestyle that gives us amenities and luxuries, the likes of which are generally out of the reach of the upper class, in a lot of other countries in the world, we really have not seen a concomitant increase in the wages.
Pull that off right there, please. All right, Fred, go right ahead, William. William was simply saying that so many Americans really don't want to defer gratification. We want what we want right now, and we can always get it with borrowed money. And because we've been pampered and we've had the opportunity to have credit cards and credit accounts and borrow money and go into debt and get whatever we wanted to. But, of course, you can't continue doing that because we are on a fiat money system.
Mm-hmm.
And the fiat money system has come to the end of the cycle, and we are on the verge of an economic collapse. Go right ahead.
Well, the interesting thing about that with respect to the fiat money system and the way that our government behaves is that it used to be the case that we could say, with great indignation about the way that our government behaves, well, I couldn't possibly behave the way Congress can behave. I couldn't possibly spend that much in excess of what I earn. I have to balance the household budget. Well, no. Thanks to the explosion of the credit and debt industry over the last generation, basically, people have been behaving just the way our government behaves. They have been maintaining an operating deficit, not just month to month, but overall, which is why over the last 2 years, for the first time since the Great Depression, interesting statistic that, we see that the aggregate American population has a negative savings rate, because all of us, to one extent or another, almost all of us, I mean, I know a few people to whom this doesn't apply, but almost all Americans are in debt, consumer debt, meaning credit cards and revolving charge accounts and such like, lines of credit, things of that sort, mortgages, car payments, payments on luxury items, and so forth. So we've been behaving almost exactly the same way that Congress behaves, because we've been able to take advantage of the same kinds of mechanisms that Congress has used, in that we've been able to go out and get cheap credit, credit on ridiculous terms. The biggest difference, of course, is that when Congress wants to, it can simply turn to the Federal Reserve and say, take out your magic checkbook, and then we will appropriate money that we will immediately borrow from you for nothing. We don't have that advantage as consumers. I mean, we have to pay back what we borrow. Congress never does. The other thing that I think is interesting, this ties into the disjunction between what we earn and what we consume, was an interesting fact that was published on the front page of the New York Times. Every once in a while, quite in defiance of the expectations and priorities of its editorial collective, the New York Times actually publishes useful, accurate news. This is one such instance. They had a story talking about how since 2000, between 2000 and 2005, the average incomes in the United States declined. That's a really interesting fact. I mean, we're not talking about failing to keep pace with inflation. We're talking about a measurable decline. The average person, according to the story, earned $55,714 adjusted for inflation in 2000. Today, that same average person earns $55,238. Almost without exception, you're talking here about the type of situation where you've got a mother and a father, both of them working part-time. They might constitute this one composite average person, or you might have a household where one earns some significant portion of that and another earns some other additional amount that takes them above the average. But you're also talking here about a situation where the average household finds it difficult to live on that amount. Now, that amount of money really is quite a bit. Even today, with inflation raging at the rate it rages, you can still live if you're the typical, say, two-and-a-half-child home, you know, let's say 4.1 people living in a household. You should be able to get by on that. You're not going to live extravagantly, depending upon where you are. If you're living in Idaho, you'll get by a lot better than you would in California on that much money. But the point is, our expectations are unrealistic. When we're making that much money because of the influence of this malevolent thing we call television and this equally malevolent entity that is the advertising industry, we believe that we are entitled to live in a way that is luxurious and opulent, as opposed to living, you know, lives that are sober and comfortable and trying to put aside money against, unemployment or some kind of catastrophic illness or accident or a system-wide economic catastrophe like we're seeing right now.
Well, I think the problem is that the American people have done it so good for so long, and my concern is what will they do when suddenly they find that the value of their life savings has simply been wiped out, and of course they are being impoverished, and of course wages are not going up, they're going down, and certainly if you're in the automotive industry working for Delphi, you've taken a 50% cut in your in your income. Certainly the major automotive concerns, General Motors and Ford, are offering a cut of 40% to their current employees, and it's a matter of take it or leave it. We'll just simply move out of the country. Ladies and gentlemen, we're in for difficult times. Well, go right ahead, William, with your story.
Well, you know, one thing that has been a subject of some discussion recently is what happened last time our country had a depression. Our country's been through four or five depressions since its founding. And it used to be that depressions were considered something that we would simply endure businesses would become more frugal, consumers would become more frugal, people would scrimp and save, they would make a point of going out and trying to earn a little bit more, spend a little bit less. The excess capacity would get shaken out of the productive sector, meaning that if you had made bad business decisions regarding where the market was going and you had overbuilt your plant or you had hired too many people to make too much of a product that the market simply wasn't interested in, then you'd make hard decisions and bring your above-the-line costs in under the operating budget again. And that would happen throughout the entire productive part of the economy. And then pretty soon things would reach equilibrium when we would recover. And the problem is that people are looking to the Federal Reserve now in the banking system, the lending and debt system, as a quasi-divine entity that can spare us the rigors of those necessary adjustments. And this really is, I think, the most dangerous form of welfare, is this false assurance that the government and Federal Reserve and the banking system are forever going to shield us from economic realities and provide to businesses the type of cushion that I just described, where they can always get money on concessionary terms, which means that they can always be increasing wages and benefits, which, of course, is something that organized labor has always demanded, and that government will always be able to keep us reasonably docile so they can keep regulating us in ways that help to drive our jobs offshore. That's something that Ron Paul pointed out a number of years ago. He was talking with several businessmen who had relocated their manufacturing concerns. They were small to medium-sized manufacturing concerns. They'd relocated offshore, some of them to the Philippines, at least a few of them to China. And Ron Paul was particularly interested in the ones relocated to China, and he asked them why they would do that, because China, of course, is a communist country. And what they said is, we don't know how to describe or explain this, but the fact is that we had less of a regulatory burden in China than we have in the United States, despite the fact that China is governed by the Communist Party. And that's a big part of the story, too. I honestly believe that if we didn't have the type of situation I just described with...
Well, hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment with William Gregg. Well, William was simply saying, before we go on with what William's conversation, William, I do want you to get your web page out and help people get in touch with you and get the information you have to offer. And then we'll get back to what, of course, the people were saying, the industrialists who had moved to China,
yeah,
and comparing the climate for certainly industry there to the climate for industry here. But how can people get your information?
The best and easiest way to read what I have to write and what I have to say is to go to rightsourceonline.com. Once again, that's rightsource, one word, rightsourceonline.com. The Right Source is a web portal that has a news page and commentaries. If you look at the left side of your screen as you call up that website, about a third of the way down, if you scroll down to the bottom of the screen, there'll be my photograph there. I'm the dark complexion fellow. Looks a little bit like a heavier Jesse Martin from Law and Order is how I've been described. It's a very flattering way of describing me. That's what my wife said. That's one reason I love her, is that she looks at me through those lenses. But there's my photograph there, and there are two links that you can click on. One of them takes you to the Pro Libertate blog, which is updated between 4 and 6 times a week. And the other is to the unfortunately dormant but soon to be revived e-zine or e-journal of the same name, Pro Libertate. And I also write quite frequently for LouRockwell.com, which is a wonderful website to visit. And my new book, Liberty in Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State, is in the final stages of editing and typesetting, I'm happy to say. We should get the cover art tomorrow, and hopefully it'll be on the presses next week, and I'll let you know when that happens, because I'd be very interested in sharing that with you and with your listeners.
Well, we're certainly looking forward to it, and we'll do everything we can to help you get that out. Now, William was simply talking about Ron Paul, Congressman Ron Paul, talking to some of the industrialists who moved to China and why they seem to prefer doing business in China to doing business in the United States. Would you like to cover that?
Yeah, this conversation, and it recounted in my last book, which was America's Engineered Decline, that conversation was revealing to Ron Paul and to me, I mean, when it was described to me, because these industrialists, of course, were taking advantage of the lower wage rate in China, but the thing they pointed out was that the regulatory burdens here in the United States were much, much greater and much more onerous. And in spite of the fact that China is ruled by the Communist Party, and Communist parties everywhere are prone to collectivize and regulate everything, what they found is that they actually were in a more favorable environment for productivity in China than they were in the United States, where they had all these multiple layers of regulation that seemed to have the perverse cumulative intention of driving business out of our country, driving it offshore. And so that's something else that I think has to be taken into consideration here. And one of the reasons why I think that we're made so materially comfortable, albeit in a rather deceptive way, is because if people really understood the way that our system was rigged to expropriate us, if they weren't able to palliate their cares and concerns with the latest consumer goodies, at least for a little while, I think we'd probably be more inclined to look with some hostile skepticism of what government is doing. We get really angry over the way that our system has been engineered. And so I think that perhaps the most insidious form of welfare we're dealing with here is this economic system, which is intended to protect us, at least for a little while, for as long as it can, before the laws of economics assert themselves, and they can do so very unpleasantly. And this is welfare that benefits the politically connected and benefits the rich most of all. I mean, when you can have these hugely influential and incomprehensibly wealthy banks go to the Federal Reserve's discount window and get cheap money to operate, that's the best example of high-end corporate welfare I can think of. And the whole system is built on that. And it simply cannot sustain itself much longer.
Well, you know, I think that the interesting thing that you were pointing out that we'd had through our history of our country, a number of depressions, maybe four or five depressions, but always in the past, we've always had a stable currency. In other words, certainly they could not simply expand the currency at whim, which is what we have today. Today, there are no restrictions on the currency. We have a fiat money system. There's a problem. We'll just, of course, print more money. We'll release more money. We'll simply lend more money. And, of course, what we're doing, we've never had a runaway inflation. We've never had an inflation rate of 11%. And this is just the beginning. If you look and see what they're really doing, they're acting totally irresponsibly. And they're increasing the credit. What they are doing by releasing the money is creating even more credit, and every time they do it, they destroy the value of the savings of the American people even more.
Yeah, and it's not only is it a form of welfare, it's also a form of taxation. The worst form of taxation is inflation, first of all, because it's something that is almost completely invisible. It is a silent killer, and it's severely regressive, because if you make less, it takes more. I mean, it's pitiless, and And what really makes me angry, Dr. Stan, just to revisit briefly a point you made a couple of segments ago about the inflation rate that we're actually experiencing as opposed to the one that's being reported, is the way that the people who report inflation to us have confected this completely bogus category that they call core inflation, and they always engineer it in such a way that the necessities are kept out of it, meaning those things without which we cannot live. We can't live without food and energy. I mean, we can live, theoretically, without a lot of the energy we use if we wanted to live, say, a Bronze Age-style existence. We could do without electricity. You know, we could do without a lot of the things that we use. But, you know, apart from the Amish, there aren't many people in this country that really want to do without electricity. That's something we have to pay for. That energy has to be generated, and that's expensive. Same thing with the automobile. I mean, the automobile is perhaps the single iconic representation of the great American ideal of freedom of movement, which, by the way, is something we no longer have thanks to the Homeland Security state. But in order to run our cars, unless we have some kind of an exotic automobile that runs on vegetable oil or sunlight or some other substitute. There are some interesting things happening in the realms of alternative energy that I think are well worth looking into. But right now, most of us have a standard internal combustion engine that is run by exploding fuel, and the fuel of choice is petroleum, and that's very expensive, too. So we can't really live without that. And obviously, we can't live without our groceries. And the price of groceries, of course, has to incorporate the price of energy, because it takes energy to produce those groceries, it takes energy to transport them and to keep them preserved until we're able to buy them and consume them. Those things are kept out of the inflation rate, that is to say the consumer inflation rate, the increase in prices, as opposed to the inflation rate, meaning the amount of money that something, by the way, the Federal Reserve is no longer reporting as of about a year and a half ago. They don't report the aggregate money supply numbers. When I found out they were going to stop doing that, I said, we're in for a lot of trouble, because obviously they're not going to spare us the good news that the money supply is contracting. So what we're dealing with here is a huge fraud meant to conceal the worst and most corrupt form of taxation, which is inflation, the creation of bogus money through the regime's official counterfeiting arm, which is the Federal Reserve. And I think that, as you said, at some point, they are going to have to let inflation rip even worse. When we've got double-digit inflation, that's a crisis right there, by any reckoning. In American terms, that's a crisis. But the only thing that restrains, quite frankly, there are only a couple of things I can think of that restrains them from going into full hyperinflationary mode. And one of those, of course, is the fact that there are very angry people who don't want to see us monetize our debts and weasel our way out of them, and some of those people are in China, some of them are in Saudi Arabia. And, of course, the other restraining factor isn't restrained at all, and that's the supply of zeros. You know, you can keep adding zeros to the currency. That's what Brazil did back in the 1970s for a while, late 1970s, when they were printing out notes that were losing value as they were on the printing press. We may live to see those times here in the United States.
Really, I think people have to understand that this is what happened in an inflationary spiral in Rhodesia, in the nation. We call it Zimbabwe today, but we created the nation of Zimbabwe. We put Robert Mugabe in power. Robert Mugabe was a Marxist thug. He was the choice of the people, and we forced him on the Rhodesian people today. The people of Rhodesia have a 10,000% a year inflation. 10,000% a year.
That's incomprehensible to me. But, you know, that's a splendid example of a perfectly horrifying thing.
And, of course, Rhodesia, I can remember when it was a country just like ours. It was stable. In fact, the Rhodesian dollar, it took three American dollars to buy one Rhodesian dollar. And, of course, today it takes, you know, what, a couple of hundred thousand Zimbabwean dollars to buy one American dollar. This is the end result, of course, irresponsibility. This is exactly what we have going on in the United States Federal Reserve System today. And the problem is that we have massive debts to China. And we're going to see these sovereign wealth funds coming in and begin to buy up the infrastructure of the United States. And they're already in the process of doing it. They're buying up our corporations. They're buying up our grocery chains. They're buying up the roads and roadways and the highways in America and the water systems and the utilities. They're being bought by foreign corporations. And soon, I believe, we will become a second and perhaps a third world nation. People say it could never happen here. The infrastructure of our nation is beginning to collapse. Mm-hmm. And there's no way we have the money to repair the potholes or the bridges or the things that we need, our highways, to keep them in first-class order.
Yeah, well, you know, the noted investor Warren Buffett a few years ago said something that shocked a lot of people, but only for a minute. And it's one of the things that really distresses me here is that people have lost their capacity to be shocked by things. He said that Americans ran the risk of, within a generation, becoming sharecroppers in this country. And he didn't say specifically who would be operating the plantation we would be sharecropping. But it's obvious that it would be China. Perhaps China and or Saudi Arabia, China and or Iran. I don't know which way they tilt. I suspect they tilt more toward Iran than Saudi Arabia. There's a little Sunni Shiite dissonance there that would make a big difference in that alignment. But The fact is, we would end up in a situation where we would be sharecroppers in our own country. And I don't think that's ever happened to a country that's not been conquered militarily. The thing that I find really interesting as well is that while this is going on, we run the real risk, unless something is done right away, of losing an entire army in the Middle East. If the idiots running the Bush administration, now there are evil people who are very intelligent behind the Bush administration, however I think the administration is overpopulated with people we'd have to call idiots. If they actually start this war with Iran that they have threatened and they have eagerly sought and courted for years now, and last week the administration was talking about designating the main component of the Iranian military a terrorist entity, which would trigger the terms of the, what was it, September 24, 2001 authorization for use of military force. If they designate the Iranian Revolutionary Guards a terrorist entity, then under the terms of that blank check that was signed in September of 2001 that would supposedly empower the president to declare war against anybody of his choosing, under that pronouncement, under that congressional enactment, the designation of the Iranian military in that fashion would provide a pretext for war, to be a backdoor for war. What they'd be saying is that, well, you know, the Iranian military has been training these insurgents that have been using these roadside bombs against the coalition forces in Iraq. They've been interfering in the sovereign affairs of Iraq, which, of course, is ludicrous on its face. What do you call an occupation with 140,000 U.S. troops? But they would use this as a rationale to spread the war to Iran. But the point is, the more deeply we become mired in that part of the world, the longer our supply chain becomes, and the more intense and tenacious the combat will become. Already, our army is badly overstretched, badly enervated by this conflict, both men and materiel. We've reached the point where, by next March, there's simply not going to be anybody to send over there. Getting them out, if we wanted to recover our equipment from Iraq, according to a report I read a couple of weeks ago, it would take something like 2.5 years to get out of Iraq, unless we want to leave everything there, which would be a strategic masterstroke. Certainly you want to be leaving arms and equipment in the hands of radical Muslims who are aligned with terrorists. That sounds like a splendid thing to do if you want to sow trouble that will blossom into chaos a little bit later. And, of course, there was this report from the Government Accountability Office that 190,000 small arms, firearms, whether you're talking about automatic weapons or handguns, went missing a few years ago at a time when David Petraeus, who's now in charge of the mission there, was in charge of arming and training the Iraqi security forces and the police. Somehow almost 200,000 weapons went missing and nobody knows where they turned up. I suspect that a lot of them turned up in the hands of the people who are shooting at American soldiers now. But this is just a horrible prospect. I mean, we could literally find ourselves in a situation where the bulk of our military is irrecoverably bogged down in Mesopotamia and Persia while our government runs out of money to get them out of there. I mean, it's not a question whether Congress could appropriate it. I mean, it's just a question of whether anybody would accept what we would be circulating. I just don't know if that's going to happen, but as I run the math, it seems like a very vivid possibility, and I don't think that sort of thing has ever happened in the history of the world before.
Well, I think that we're in very real problems, because everything I hear is that they probably are going to go ahead with, well, it's only going to be a very, very short war with Iran. It's only going to last about 6 days, and our boys will be, was it home by Thanksgiving or is it home by Christmas?
Mm.
They just never tell us which Thanksgiving or which Christmas. And there are people in Washington, D.C., who really do want to go to war with Iran, which doesn't make any logical sense. Right now, we're having to borrow close to $3.5 billion every day just to pay our debts. We have essentially no significant reserves. Russia has far more reserves than the United States does today.
Oh, isn't that bizarre? Isn't that bizarre? I mean, you remember the old Soviet era joke, how we have an agreement, the Soviet workers would say, with our government, we pretend to work and they pretend to pay us. And the thing is, Russia is, as you said, economically healthier than we are right now because they're becoming one of the world energy powers. They're becoming the Saudi Arabia of natural gas, as well as, of course, having significant oil reserves. Well, that's the reversal of fortunes I would not have expected 15 years ago.
Well, of course, but where did the money come from it?
Well, there you go.
It came from the Export-Import Bank, from the World Bank, from the International Monetary Fund,
OPIC.
From American corporations. They built they drilled the wells, and they built the pipelines. And, of course, then Exxon had a $20 billion contract. Shell had a $20 billion contract in Russia. BP had a $20 billion contract in Russia. Shucks, that's where the money came from.
Sure.
Well, William, we've got 3 minutes to wrap up this evening's fascinating program.
Well, I do think that as dismal as things appear, there are always ways that we can surmount our circumstances. First of all, none of this is written in stone. I'm not a fatalist. I don't believe that our doom has been decreed and that the decree is irreversible. Irrevocable. I do think that it is still possible, however unlikely it might seem right now, that a significant portion of the public will come to its senses. Often that's something which has to be spurred by a crisis. I remember in 1979 we had a similar convergence of events that led people to take a serious look at what's going on, and there was, between I think 1979 and 1982, some reason for optimism. It was short-circuited, unfortunately, in many ways, because people became too invested in the personality of Ronald Reagan to pay attention to the principles here that Ronald Reagan was supposed to represent. He was, of course, not famously faithful to those principles. But we have a situation now where at least people through the alternative media, through the Internet, through YouTube, through talk radio and so forth, have been communicating with each other without the filters of the establishment gatekeepers, and we're comparing notes, and we're getting angry, and that's a very healthy thing. People need to recover their capacity for anger, shock, and outrage, and once that happens, they might be able to inform themselves and inform other people, and from that, we might be able to build a foundation for some real change. And it's going to have to happen quickly, because at some point, to alter my metaphor of the avalanche, the deluge is going to break. And I think that that's going to happen a lot more quickly than most Americans are prepared for. Be a good time to go out and invest in gold, gold and silver. Be a good time to go out and invest in lead, in the form of ammunition. That's always a good thing to have. Be a good time to go out and buy some food, because I suspect the price of food is going to shoot up pretty quickly. But don't go off the grid. Stay in touch with people. Keep active in what's going on. Don't isolate yourselves. You know, we have to work together, and we have to look to each other's interests, both as families, as loved ones, and, of course, as fellow patriots. You know, this is a time where we need to be cognizant of what's happening and willing to accept the worst at face value and to address it forthrightly and to do what we can, whatever is within the compass of our abilities that God gave us, make things just a little bit better. I mean, it has to be done. We've got no alternative.
Very, very well said. Our guest this evening has been William Grieg. William, thank you so very much for being with
us.
It's been
God
a real
bless.
Pleasure. And, of course, I hope our listeners really listened. Good night. God bless. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I hope that you listened to William Grieg this evening. What he's saying is so very important. We're caught in an inflationary spiral. We have nothing behind our dollar. We are a bankrupt nation fiscally and morally. And, of course, none of this is happening by accident. It is my contention that all of this is planned by very powerful forces working within the shadows. What are those forces? Well, you need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You need, of course, to hear my second talk. On the forbidden secret. That's the forbidden secret. And then I talk on the world revolution. You need to get our talk on, certainly, by me, our 4-tape or 4-CD set, The Secret Behind the Secret, our 4-tape set on the supernatural, and the book that goes with that entitled The Beautiful Side of Evil. And then, of course, a 4-tape set, The Wisdom of Malachi Martin, and that comes with a book called Hostage to the Devil. It will begin to give you an insight into things that are seldom talked about in our churches, and yet, of course, they should be, because of the very essence of what's going on spiritually and, of course, politically today. Well, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we're really dependent upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out 5 hours every day, certainly by radio, shortwave, internet, and satellite. And if you want to know more about Radio Liberty, our webpage is radioliberty.com, where you can hear our programs either live on the internet or certainly archived there. Well, let me just remind our listeners what we said in the last hour, and that is that certainly we hear from our people who provide food, the Ready Reserve Food Company, that they're having increasing difficulty getting milk and milk products. They're having difficulty getting seeds now because so many of the seeds that they've offered in the past are now genetically engineered. Certainly the corn products that they can get, the only thing they can get, we would have to assume would be genetically altered, and this is not safe for human consumption. And yet, of course, they're feeding it to people all across America, and then we wonder why so many people are sick and have cancer and other diseases. But, of course, the food that they have is not genetically engineered, but, of course, it's coming down the line. If you want to get good food, if you want to get it before the prices really go sky high and you're interested, give us a call. We'd be glad to send you an emergency food catalog, or if you already have one, don't delay. I mean, don't put this off, and I say this in all sincerity. Prepare, because we are in for some very difficult times. If we get into a war with Iran, you can be sure that they're only going to be able to do that by staging some terrorist attack in the United States. If there was really a threat of Islamic terrorism, if what had happened on 9/11 had happened as we've been told, they would have immediately closed our southern border to keep more terrorists from coming into this country. They would have immediately armed every marshal on. We would have planes on every plane. We have air marshals on every plane. We don't. There are only 10%. Why would we only have 10% of our planes with air marshals on them? And the answer is really very simple. Because they don't believe there's really the problem that they want us to believe in. And unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, of course, we have people who are quite willing to use the threat of terrorism to justify a police state in America. Because there are people who have a different worldview, a different world vision. If you have not yet read our pamphlets on Foreknowledge 911, here at our 4-7, why did the buildings come down? 911 update, the various videos that we offer through our ministry, certainly you need to get them. If you'd like a free catalog from Radio Liberty, our telephone number 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927 or 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is under attack today, and not from the terrorists, but from people right here in America who have a different world vision because they worship a different God.